Okay, so we finished up with wound healing last time. All right, so today let's talk about factors that affect both inflammation and wound healing. The first one is blood supply. Now, what is it that causes redness and heat in the body when you have inflammation? Vasodilation. Vasodilation causes more blood flow to go to the area, causes redness and heat. What is it that causes the edema? Okay, increased interstitial fluid is edema, but what causes it? So capillary permeability increases, which allows plasma proteins to leak out into the blood, which causes a decrease in plasma osmotic pressure, causing edema. Now, all three of those functions are dependent on blood supply, yes. Arteries going to that area. Now, who has fewer arteries? Elderly and feet. Okay, those aren't a who, it's a what. So there's less blood supply to the feet, and that gets even worse as a person gets older. Also, the elderly do not have as good a blood supply. Two reasons for that. As they get older, some of the arteries just go away. It's called arterial rarefaction. One of the reasons why elderly people look more pale, because they don't have as many arteries in their skin. At the same time, they've had more time for diseases like peripheral arterial disease to decrease the amount of blood flow that they had to begin with. So who's at risk for not having good inflammatory responses in their feet? Elderly. Who's at risk for not having good arterial supply? Period. Elderly. Next one is bone marrow function. Now, what does inflammation depend on? Say it again. T cells, what else? B cells, what else? Dendritic cells, what else? Macrophages, what else? Neutrophils. Now, where do all these things come from? The bone marrow. So if you don't have good bone marrow function, guess what you will not have? You will not have a good immune reaction or inflammatory reaction. Next one is protein synthesis. Now, what proteins can you identify that your body uses in the inflammatory process? What's the number one plasma protein? Albumin. Is that involved in the inflammatory process? No. What's the number two, though? Starts with an I. Yes. And ends with globulins. Immunoglobulins. And what's another name for immunoglobulins? Antibodies. All right, so antibodies are the number one protein in the inflammatory process. What else do we have? The immune process. What other proteins have we identified? There's a series of nine of them. It's like a waterfall flowing down. Cascade, what cascade is that? The complement cascade. So the complement cascade is another series of proteins. What other proteins have we learned about? Clotting factors, that's another one. TNF-alpha. And even things that aren't necessarily proteins like histamine still come from amines, amino acids. So the inflammatory process is highly dependent on having adequate supply of proteins. So if a person has blank or blank problems, they're going to have trouble with their inflammatory processes. So how do we get proteins? We eat them. And then our liver is going to process them and get them into a usable form. Another couple big proteins that we haven't mentioned, CRP, C-reactive protein, the mannose binding lectin, and the surfactants. We talked about them last class, but today. So, and then finally we have this one right here, medications. There are a lot of drugs that can affect inflammation. There's drugs that can increase it, and there's drugs that can decrease it. And we'll talk about some of those. Now, factors affecting wound healing. In addition to everything we just talked about, we have necrotic or foreign tissue in the wound. How many of you have ever gotten a splinter that you couldn't quite dig out? And what happened? It stayed in there, it started festering, it becomes infected. Why is that? Your body does not like to heal when you have foreign tissue in that area. If you have necrotic or dead tissue in that area, that tissue has to be removed before healing can take place. The removal can take place in one of two different ways. What are they? Okay, it can be physically removed, and some of the inflammatory processes your body does actually tries to push stuff to the surface. Or we could cut it out or chemically remove it. What's the other way that can be removed? Phagocytes. What are the two phagocytes? Macrophages and neutrophils can eat the dead tissue and remove it that way. Then we have infection. No matter how hard you try, you're not going to heal very well if you have an infection in your wound. That's why, as nurses, one of the biggest things that we have to do in the hospital is try to prevent wound infections. Next one is excessive movement. Any of you ever have a cut that was starting to heal, and then you did something stupid, and you made it open up again because you're moving around too much? Now, what kind of cuts are the hardest to heal? Well, I mean, in terms of movement, what areas would have excessive movement, making it harder to heal? Okay, on the joints especially. Now, if we had to cut for just a moment, I will reveal my arm. Now, if we had to make a cut right here, would we want the cut to go this way or this way? Which one would be harder to heal? So if we cut it this way, every time you did this, it would split open or want to split open again. If we did it this way, it wouldn't have as much of a tendency to want to split every time the person moves their arm. So now that you're not going to be responsible for that. That's going to be the surgeon. But it's something for you to understand that you want to always cut in the same direction as tension. Yeah, the tension lines want to, what you'd like for them to do is pull end to end on that cut, not pull it open. So areas that have a lot of movement, your back, your abdomen. What do you do 12 to 20 times a second? You breathe. Okay, so you use your abdominal muscles to stabilize you. Anything that's in a high movement area is going to have trouble. Next, we have something we call dehiscence. Dehiscence is what happens when you begin to heal and then pop, opens up again. Looks something kind of like that in some people. Can't really see that too well. Yeah, beautiful, isn't it? So, and the reason for this is because what happened was the skin healed over, but it didn't have a good connective tissue other than the skin itself. The person thought they were more healed than they really were. They did too much movement, ripped it back open. So as nurses, one of the big things we want to do is help support patients in terms of bandages and also in terms of educating them on what they should and should not be doing. Now, sometimes when you don't have good wound healing because of those protein issues and inflammatory issues, it's very difficult for us to prevent these things from happening. So you want to give, you don't just treat the patient in terms of the wound, you want to treat the entire patient. If they're having inflammatory issues, if they're having nutrition issues, you want to give them every opportunity to heal. I'm going to change gears a little bit, and we're going to talk about hypersensitivity reactions. What's the common word for hypersensitivity reactions? Allergic. Although technically speaking, not all hypersensitivity reactions are allergic, but you can think of them as exactly the same thing. So there are four types. How many? Four. Guess how many you're going to need to know for the test? Four. You'll need to know their names and how they work and some common examples. So the first type is called anaphylactic type reaction. Now, just because it's called anaphylactic does not mean it always leads to anaphylactic shock. It's just the type of reaction. If it gets severe enough, it will lead to anaphylactic shock. And for those of you who have seen Hitch, I know you're tired of me referencing the movie, but it's a very good example of what this type of reaction looks like. So what we get is you have an immune response to some antigen. We'll say pollen in this case. Now, the first time you get exposed, your body begins to produce antibodies. The antibody that we're talking about in particular is IgE. Now, IgE is going to embed itself in basophils and mast cells. So it's kind of like, you know, they have a receptor that holds IgE. Then the moment the IgE gets activated by a new pollen molecule, maybe next time the pollen season comes back around, you get an instant degranulation of mast cells and eosinophils. And histamine is the major thing that is being released that's going to cause the swelling and symptoms in this case. So what we're going to get is we're going to get huge amounts of vasodilation in the area where these eosinophils and mast cells were. And in the case of pollen, that's probably going to be your where's that going to be in the case of pollen? In your nose, yes. Gosh, is that so difficult? All right, so in the case of pollen, it would be your nose. In the case of a bee sting, it would be where you got stung. In the case of food, it would be kind of all over because it's going from anywhere from your lips all the way down to the other end. Systemic effects. If you get too much release of histamine, instead of just acting locally, it will begin to act systemically. And you can get laryngeal edema and bronchial edema, which can lead to asphyxiation and death. What is the treatment for anaphylactic shock? Say again? Epinephrine, and given how? Injection, but where? In the fat, that's called subcutaneous. And what's the delivery device that we're commonly associated with that? The EpiPen. Now, if a person does not have an anaphylactic shock, but they just have this kind of reaction, what do you think the major drug class we use to treat this is? Antihistamines. So histamine is the major actor. So if we inhibit histamines, we can inhibit a lot of the reaction. Not all of it, because there are other things involved, but we can inhibit a lot of it. All right, some common anaphylactic type reactions. We have insect stings, penicillin, pollen, animal dander. This is what cats and dogs give off. Foods, allergic rhinitis, which can be caused by anything from mold to cigarette smoke to pollen to perfumes. Yes, don't wear perfume in the hospital. Guys, I know that you're all about that, but just say no to the Dracar. That's like an eighth grade scent. I think by the time you turn 14, you're no longer allowed to wear that. Angioedema and urticaria. Now, what do we say this word urticaria is? It was in health assessment last week on Thursday, towards the end of the class. What? Well, it does cause itching, but what is urticaria? It's an H word. It's what bees live in. Hives. Okay, so hives The disease of having hives is called, or the condition of having hives is called urticaria. And what do we say urticaria was characterized by? Localized swelling and edema. Now, with hives, you usually get a very small area. Sometimes, though, someone will have a bigger reaction, and their hand or wherever it is just really swells up, and that's called angioedema. It's associated with bug bites and drugs, certain food allergies. It's just a worse case of hives. Something atopic dermatitis. Atopic dermatitis is highly associated with asthma, which is our next one, and asthma is actually a type 1 allergic reaction. Isn't that fun? So you need to be familiar with these things, that they are type 1 reactions mediated by histamine and can be treated mildly with antihistamines. We'll learn some other drugs eventually that can also be used to treat them, but the major thing is histamine, antihistamine. And if it becomes anaphylactic shock, EpiPen subcutaneously. All right, here is a little graphic of our process. So the first thing we get is we get a dendritic cell, which activates T cells, which in turn tells a B cell to produce antibody. The antibody sticks itself inside of a mast cell or an eosinophil. Well, a mast cell in this case, or an eosinophil here. What happens when you get the pollen reactivating it, or whatever antigen it is, you get a massive release of histamine, draws even more eosinophils to the area. The eosinophils and the mast cells begin to attack whatever it is, causing inflammation. Now, this is what's supposed to happen, but if instead of being this little parasite worm, which is what this system is designed to do, it happens to be a poor, innocent little piece of pollen, then we get disease.
So if you're young and let's say you have an allergy to peanuts, but you've never had peanut butter, and the first time you eat peanut butter, would you react like this, or is it the second?
Okay. If you've never, ever had any exposure to peanuts before, the very first time, you would not react this way. The problem is a lot of times we have foods that we don't really know we've been exposed to, and so we think it's the first time we've had it, but it might really not be. And this is one of the reasons why we tell parents now, don't let your kids have peanut butter until they're, you know, 2 or 3 years old. Because if they're very small babies, you know, the reaction can be so harmful that they can die before you can treat them adequately. All right. Any other questions about that?
Are certain, ethnic groups are more prone to building?
I'm not sure about ethnic groups. Yeah. There is an overall rise in the number of type 1 reactions, especially atopic dermatitis and asthma in this country. And there was a hypothesis for a while that it was because, you know, we were trying to be so clean that we didn't expose our children to enough antigens early on, and so they had these inappropriate immune reactions. They've since found out that being clean by itself doesn't impact it, but we do know that people who live in rural areas tend to have less of it than live in urban areas. So it might have something to do with pollution. We're not really sure exactly what causes it. There's also another thing for a while. They said if you have a child who has atopic dermatitis, treat them very early on with antihistamines and you can prevent asthma from occurring. But then they found out that didn't really work. So, you know, again, we're still learning about it. You know, what's interesting is, when I went to nursing school in 97, there were some physicians I knew who didn't believe in allergies. Yeah. Even though we have, you know, we understand the pathological mechanisms, we have drugs to treat them, you know, the physicians were like, I just don't buy it. I just don't believe they exist. You know, so, yeah, and that was even as late as the mid-90s. So, you know, our understanding has come a long way.